344, chapters 20 and 21.
Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion.
Episode 344, again with the moving? This episode brought to you by Survival Organs. Handmade organs to throw, love, or cuddle. Sewn by a survivor, for your survivor.
And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter delivered to your mailbox, bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at www.knitcircus.com.
And March Hare Yarns, hand-dyed yarn just for you. You can visit the March Hare at Etsy. And Pennywise Consulting, technology solutions for your small business. Links to all of our sponsors' pages can be found in the show notes at craftlit.com. Remember, their support for the show is what keeps it free for you. So go take a look. Well, hello. Oh, how I have missed you. It's impossible for me to express just how much I've missed you, because the fact of having missed you means I moved twice in 3 weeks, but I'm still not done with the moving thing. This last one really almost did me in. I've discovered that I am even more of a nester than I thought I was, and having a completely unsettled home environment, one where there are things that don't work like air conditioning, that I have no control over, really does bad things to me. So I appreciate your forbearance and your patience. I especially appreciate the good wishes and lovely emails that I have gotten from many of you saying, good grief, Heather, chill. If you skip a week, it's okay. But it isn't okay because this week's chapters are really awesome. And I felt really bad not being able to put them out right away for you. But because so much time has passed, I've collected a bunch of other stuff too, and then it was, you know. So if you are among the people who signed up for the Craftlit mailing list, you received an email on Friday saying, holy cow, I'm not going to make it, and I'm really sorry. I'll try and get the podcast out as fast as I can. Part of what happened was, yes, I couldn't podcast while dripping on the keyboard and microphone, as I would have short-circuited them, and the air conditioning was out for an unspecified length of time. It was quite an extensive outage on some very hot days. And then the day that it got fixed was, of course, cool and lovely and wonderful. But the second thing that happened was I went and spoke Friday night at Second Story Knits in Bethesda, Maryland, and I had the most awesome group of both podcast listeners and non-podcast listeners, which is always exciting, who came to find out about the Defarge books and see some of the finished objects and get copies of the books and get copies of Grounded and hear a little bit about how my unique life has moved me from working in Hollywood through teaching into podcasting and eventually writing and then writing young adult fiction into doing brain and neuroscience research to find out what exactly knitting is doing to our brains and what the benefits are of the things that knitting is doing, because there are three completely separate things that we can get out of knitting or crocheting or doodling or anything that we can do automatically with our hands without necessarily having to look. And again, all of this information is over at the cognitiveanchoring.com website, but there's been a lot of really interesting research going on just in the last 2 months, and there are questions people have started asking at things like Friday night that have led me to start doing some other research. Listener Marta Schmarta is also kind of nudging me in this direction. And so the book, which is in the hands of the editor right now, as I mentioned, we're expanding it a chunk. It's going to be good. And that's great for everyone, because just waiting these couple of months to really work on the draft and make it good means that new research has been coming out. So it's exciting. There's a lot of really good information out there. If you, your local yarn store, or your guild are interested in having me come and give a talk on cognitive anchoring and the benefits of these kinds of handicrafts that we all love doing, please contact me. If you go to the show notes for episode 344, you will see close to the top, I've got a new section that says, I've got a show and I'm taking it on the road. And there are links to give you more information about classes I teach, the cognitive anchoring talks I do, patterns that I've written, and there is a link to contact me directly with questions about whether I can come or not. And if you follow any of the text-based links that aren't my email, it'll take you to a page where you can even just book me, because it'll have a calendar and you'll be able to see if I'm busy or not. And the next thing on the show notes is, don't forget the May raffle, which is still going on. Just because I haven't been here doesn't mean the raffle page hasn't been up and ticking off people as they come and throw their name in the ring for the May book, which is the Mommy and Me Crocheted Hats, 30 Fun and Stylish Designs for Kids of All Ages by Christy Simpson. There are links in the show notes to the raffle page, and from the raffle page you can get more information on that book itself. And I am working on the raffle lots for Nanette the Nanny's books, but along with the podcasting thing, that's taken a bit of a backseat as I've tried to just unpack the kitchen in the ungodly dripping heat. So now that that part's over, I hope to get to finalizing the lots and figuring out how to put them up so that everybody can, you know, have at them. So that is happening on the show notes. I don't know if you've looked at the show notes lately, but the last month or so, I've been adding goofy art pictures where I've taken classical pieces of art and added headphones and iPods in the hands of the people. This week it's The Thinker. So if you like The Thinker, take a look. It's pinnable and it's also stealable. You'll see that there is text you can copy and paste to put our art on your website. I have another speaking engagement that's coming up June 1st at a little after 1 p.m. I will be at Yarn Cloud, which is in Woodbridge, Virginia, down the 95 from DC. I'm going to be there with Robin. We'll do a little Defarge, some cognitive anchoring, some finished objects, a little groundedness, and of course, I'll sign anything you bring that I am affiliated with. And then I'm still speaking in Vienna, Virginia, at the Uniquities Yarn Shop on June 21st, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. And The Tangled Web, I will be making an appearance on July 11th at The Tangled Web for the kickoff of their summer camp. Their summer camp will be focusing on the Madame Defarge Knits books, and everybody who participates in the camp will be choosing something from one of those books. So I'll be on hand to help people figure out what would be best for them and what kind of yarn they like best and what of the many varied projects that are in those books they might be most interested in working on. To understand a little bit about why it is so hard for me to leave Pennsylvania and come back down here to Virginia, because Virginia is gorgeous and lovely and I have wonderful friends here and people who I'm going to miss very much, but to make the comparison pretty crystalline, if you go to the show notes and scroll down to general news, the first thing you'll see is a picture. It's a very pretty green picture with a tree with pink flowers, and it's lovely. And if you click on it, it's a video. And that video is the view off our front porch. It was Mother's Day. I was sitting there with my older son, just looking, just enjoying the view. And I thought, oh, gosh, I need to take a picture. And my phone flipped to video, and I thought, oh, good. Now I can remember how lovely the birds were. So that is available. I also, when I thought I was recording last week, one of the things that happened as I was sitting here writing frantically was my phone pinged me and said, watch the live stream of the 9/11 Memorial Museum dedication. And my brain, of course, went, what? 9/11 Memorial Museum? Why, I worked on curriculum for the 9/11 Memorials Museum. I'm very interested to see what this dedication ceremony is going to look like. So I went ahead and I flipped it on my phone and I'm watching, and it was lovely. It was lovely. It was classy. They held the dedication exactly where I thought they would, in the big chamber that you have to walk down into that's up against the slurry wall. And if you ever saw pictures of them as they were excavating the pit, you probably noticed that the wall closest to the west, closest to the Hudson River side of the pit, was a big concrete wall with what looked like ginormous nuts and bolts sticking out of it at funky angles. And as far as I understand, those are kind of like nuts and bolts. That's what's holding that slurry wall up. And that's what's keeping the Hudson River out of the foundation of that whole area. And so when you're down in the Memorial Museum, you are down in the sub-basements of what had been the World Trade Center towers. And it's phenomenal. And they did such a lovely job of showing you bits and pieces of the artifacts that I talked about. I think it was, it had to be early 2011 or even maybe 2010 when I was working on this, because I know I was back in Tucson and I can remember the room I was sitting in when I was working on it. So they showed some of my favorite artifacts. I have linked to one of the many articles on the memorial opening that happened that day. And the first picture on the page that I linked to is something that I told you about, I believe, lo those many years ago, that there was a fire truck. And if you approach the fire truck from the position that they had it in, at least when they were setting stuff up, I don't know if it's still in this position, but you approached it from an angle where you look at it and you go, oh, well, it's a fire truck and it's been, you know, awfully scratched up and it's kind of dusty. And it looks like it's been through the ringer, sure. But it isn't until you get to the other end of it that you realize that the entire section of the fire truck was sheared off and completely compressed and smushed. It no longer looks like a fire truck. It looks like strands of metal that have gone through a meat grinder. It's just shreds of metal. And, you know, that's what happens when a building lands on a fire truck, is that. So there's stuff that's heartbreaking. There's the shoes of a woman who's in a very famous picture carrying her shoes, having run down, you know, 68 flights of stairs and covered in ash and weeping. And her shoes are in the Memorial Museum. And these iconic things that we all saw photographs of or that we all heard stories about, they're all there. And it was lovely, and it was heartbreaking in a good kind of way. And then my principal walked out on stage. And I had a sneaking suspicion she was going to be there, and I was so happy to see her. For one thing, she's just gorgeous, and she hasn't changed at all in all of the time that it's been. I have aged considerably. She has not at all. And she was one of the last people to speak. So if you watched this, there was that really lovely, short, dark-haired Puerto Rican woman who got up to speak at the end talking about after being involved in this tragedy and losing her sister in Cantor Fitzgerald, she got to go build a school in Afghanistan, which she thought was the perfect blow-it-out-your-shorts Bin Laden moment of saying, oh, really? You're going to drop buildings on me? Guess what? I'm going to build a school for girls and boys, but there are going to be girls there. And that's what I'm going to do back. And I just love that. And what a great way to end it. You know, it was lovely. Everybody who spoke, it really was. It was just great. I really, really, really liked watching it. And that doesn't mean I didn't cry. It just means I really, really liked it. And of course, all of that brought me back to cognitive anchoring and the kids that I taught in New York City and how that related to all of the brain research that I've been doing over the last year and a half. So it kind of tied everything up with a nice little knot. And that made some very difficult days much more pleasant. Actually, it's strange to say that, but watching the 9/11 feed that day was oddly calming in the middle of the crazy. And I have a feeling it's because as crazy and scary and horrifying as the actual day was, the 9/11 Memorial Museum was unknown to me. I'd seen most of it. I'd heard most of the stories from the people who spoke. And so it was very kind of almost settling because it was things I already knew and was comfortable with, although I was sitting in an apartment that I wasn't comfortable with and that I didn't know very well and that didn't respond when I did things like turned on switches. And so, isn't that a weird thing, though, that something like that could actually make you feel more calm and like you're still in a world that you at least know. It may not be a wonderful world, it may not be a beautiful world, but it's at least a known world, and that was oddly comforting, which is interesting, she says now, suddenly thinking about it, because isn't that a little bit like Margaret Hale, that the longer she is in this culture that she didn't know at all, the more comfortable she is getting with it, and that actually pops up in today's chapters. So chapter 20, our first chapter today, is the party that we've been waiting for. And we know what Margaret's going to wear, and we know that she is kind of not looking forward to it. And we know that Mrs. Thornton is not so thrilled about inviting her in the first place. And, you know, drama. But we also it's the first time that we're going to see Margaret in her element, in that she is at a fashionable party. And I'm not entirely making air quotes. I'm making half air quotes because it's fashionable. It's actually quite fashionable and desirable to be there if you are of that world, Milton Northern. And it's probably not quite so fashionable if you are straight from London. But she is neither. She went from London to Halston and spent time there before they left. And so she's, you know, twice removed now from London. It's been a long time since she's worn these clothes. It's been a long time since she's been at a place like this. And it is going to be a bit of culture shock, which isn't a surprise to any of us. But some of the things that she thinks while she is there were certainly a surprise to me. In fact, there was an article earlier this week. I think it was in The Guardian. I will go dig this up, but it was hilarious because it was little short snippets of different people's favorite books and the characters that they were jazzed by. And Margaret Hale shows up in one of these little blurbs. And there's this awesome little throwaway line that Mr. Thornton is Darcy with flat vowels. But it also, just love that, but it's also highlighted something that I think a lot of us are starting to notice and be kind of curious about, that Margaret Hale is really so not a Jane Austen heroine. Because if she were, this party would be the first major turning point, the first big pinnacle of, romance between the two people who we know are going to have to fall in love somehow, some way. We just don't know how, and we don't know when, and we don't know how long it's going to take. But that is not the case in this story. Margaret has other things on her mind. She has the strikers, the people who have turned out. They call it the people who are on strike have turned out. And listen, there's a one line, it goes by pretty quickly, about what has stopped strikes in the past. And it should be pretty chilling. So since we've spent so much time with Bessie and with Higgins and even with Boucher, you know, we're starting to get more and more of a picture of what's really going on with the workers now that they are on strike. The statement that is made about what has ended these uprisings previously threw me because I wasn't expecting it. And it made me very worried. And then they've got, you know, Mr. Hale, who's just, dude, is like wishful thinking central. He absolutely does not seem capable of connecting reality. And I am not sure if Elizabeth Gaskell meant for him to come across as quite so wussy, or if it's just a byproduct of what he had to be in order to allow Margaret to be stronger. I'm not sure. I have not sussed that one out yet, but it is a little on the wishful thinking side in this one. There's also that lovely dichotomy between people coming from the rural South or from London and appreciating the pastoral and appreciating kind of Arcadia, and that is the height of beauty and culture and pride is, you know, your gardens or your the meadow or how many gorgeous fields there are in your valley, how great your hedgerows are. And in Milton Northern, the pride would be in the factories. It would be in your technology. It would be in how loud the place was when everything was working and how that was a physical fact. You know, that kind of sound is a physical fact of your wealth, of your prosperity, of your ingenuity, that you were able to put this thing together and make it work. That would have been huge. And that is so different from anything Margaret or even most of us have probably ever known. And what with this being a book about a young woman written by a woman, you know that at some point something's going to give and you are going to have a fashion break. There will be a moment where fashion is discussed, and it happens in this chapter, and it's really rather brief, but it is interesting because, of course, the styles are very different from the styles during Jane Austen's time. So you can listen for that. If you are somebody who read a lot of Jane Austen, this will be new. But it's all, and we, of course, we don't get the fashion thing from Dickens, even with Lady Dedlock in Bleak House. At the most, you get descriptions of kind of her regal posture, or her neck, or her hair is never out of place, but you really don't get clothing. Here you're going to get some clothing, which is fun. But you're also going to get conversation. And that part of this chapter, I remember the first time I read through this, blew me away. Because again, not Jane Austen, not Charlotte Bronte, not any chick lit I've read from this era or you know, reasonably relatively before this era. I was stunned. And I hope you are too. It seemed to me to be such a welcome departure. And again, one of those things where in reading the book, I keep thinking, wow, this is exactly what happened with Wilkie Collins. I keep thinking, why isn't this book read in school? Why isn't anyone studying this book the way that we do Pride and Prejudice or anything like that? Because this is a fascinating look at human nature, for one thing, but also really kind of blowing apart the myths of the quiet, retiring, perfect woman, because Margaret isn't. I mean, she obviously still knows her place, quote unquote. That time I am using air quotes, but she's way more out there than I would ever have guessed. And then chapter 21, which we'll just listen to back to back, is the follow-up. Because, of course, if you're going to have fun, one must pay for it. And so not everything can be a bed of roses. And 20 and 21 are kind of the back-to-back of this one particular night and the aftermath of it. And there's one term that's going to throw you, but I promise I will explain it when we get to the other side. So that is where I am going to leave you and let you listen to chapters 20 and 21 of North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell.
Chapter 20. Men and Gentlemen.
Old and young, boy, let 'em all eat. I have it. Let 'em have 10 tire of teeth apiece. I care not.
Rollo, Duke of Normandy. Margaret went home so painfully occupied with what she had heard and seen that she hardly knew how to rouse herself up to the duties which awaited her. The necessity for keeping up a constant flow of cheerful conversation for her mother, who, now that she was unable to go out, always looked to Margaret's return from the shortest walk as bringing in some news.
"And can your factory friend come on Thursday to see you dressed?"
"She was so ill I never thought of asking her," said Margaret dolefully.
"Dear, everybody is ill now, I think," said Mrs. Hale, with a little of the jealousy which one invalid is apt to feel of another. "But it must be very sad to be ill in one of those little back streets," her kindly nature prevailing and the old Helston habits of thought returning. "It's bad enough here. What could you do for her, Margaret? Mr. Thornton has sent me some of his old port wine since you went out. Would a bottle of that do her good, think you?"
"No, Mama. I don't believe they are very poor. At least, they don't speak as if they were. And, at any rate, Bessie's illness is consumption. She won't want wine. Perhaps I might take her a little preserve made of our dear Helston fruit. No, there's another family whom I should like to give. Oh, Mama, Mama, how am I to dress up in my finery and go off and away to smart parties after the sorrow I have seen today?"
exclaimed Margaret, bursting the bounds she had preordained for herself before she came in, and telling her mother of what she had seen and heard at Higgins's cottage. It distressed Mrs. Hale excessively. It made her restlessly irritated till she could do something. She directed Margaret to pack up a basket in the very drawing-room to be sent there and then to the family, and was almost angry with her for saying that it would not signify if it did not go till morning, as she knew Higgins had provided for their immediate wants, and she herself had left money with Bessie. Mrs. Hale called her unfeeling for saying this, and never gave herself breathing time till the basket was sent out of the house. Then she said,
"After all, we may have been doing wrong. It was only the last time Mr. Thornton was here that he said those were no true friends who helped to prolong the struggle by assisting the turnouts. And this Boucher man was a turnout, was he not?"
The question was referred to Mr. Hale by his wife when he came upstairs, fresh from giving a lesson to Mr. Thornton, which had ended in conversation, as was their wont. Margaret did not care if their gifts had prolonged the strike. She did not think far enough for that in her present excited state. Mr. Hale listened and tried to be as calm as a judge. He recalled all that had seemed so clear not half an hour before as it came out of Mr. Thornton's lips. And then he made an unsatisfactory compromise. His wife and daughter had not only done quite right in this instance, but he did not see for a moment how they could have done otherwise. Nevertheless, as a general rule, it was very true what Mr. Thornton said, that as the strike, if prolonged, must end in the master's bringing hands from a distance, if, indeed, the final result were not, as it had often been before, the invention of some machine which would diminish the need of hands at all, why, it was clear enough that the kindest thing was to refuse all help which might bolster them up in their folly. But as to this Boucher, he would go and see him the first thing in the morning and try to find out what could be done for him. Mr. Hale went the next morning as he proposed. He did not find Boucher at home, but he had a long talk with his wife, promised to ask for an infirmary order for her, and seeing the plenty provided by Mrs. Hale and somewhat lavishly used by the children, who were masters downstairs in their father's absence, he came back with a more consoling and cheerful account than Margaret had dared to hope for. Indeed, what she had said the night before had prepared her father for so much worse a state of things that, by a reaction of his imagination, he described all as better than it really was.
"But I will go again and see the man himself," said Mr. Hale. "I hardly know as yet how to compare one of these houses with our Helston cottages. I see furniture here which our labourers would never have thought of buying, and food commonly used which they would consider luxuries. Yet for these very families there seems no other resource now that their weekly wages are stopped but the pawn shop. One had need to learn a different language and measure by a different standard up here in Milton."
Bessie, too, was rather better this day. Still, she was so weak that she seemed to have entirely forgotten her wish to see Margaret dressed, if, indeed, that had not been the feverish desire of a half-delirious state. Margaret could not help comparing this strange dressing of hers to go where she did not care to be, her heart heavy with various anxieties, with the old merry girlish toilette that she and Edith had performed scarcely more than a year ago. Her only pleasure now in decking herself out was in thinking that her mother would take delight in seeing her dressed. She blushed when Dixon, throwing the drawing-room door open, made an appeal for admiration.
"Miss Hale looks well, Mum, doesn't she? Mrs. Shaw's coral couldn't have come in better. It just gives the right touch of colour, Mum. Otherwise, Miss Margaret, you would have been too pale."
Margaret's black hair was too thick to be plaited. It needed rather to be twisted round and round, and have its fine silkiness compressed into massive coils that encircled her head like a crown, and then were gathered into a large spiral knot behind. She kept its weight together by two large coral pins, like small arrows for length. Her white silk sleeves were looped up with strings of the same material, and on her neck, just below the base of her curved and milk-white throat, there lay heavy coral beads.
"Oh, Margaret, how I should like to be going with you to one of the old Barrington assemblies, taking you as Lady Beresford used to take me."
Margaret kissed her mother for this little burst of maternal vanity, but she could hardly smile at it. She felt so much out of spirits.
"I would rather stay at home with you, much rather, Mama."
"Nonsense, darling. Be sure you notice the dinner well. I shall like to hear how they manage these things in Milton, particularly the second course, dear. Look what they have instead of game."
Mrs. Hale would have been more than interested. She would have been astonished if she had seen the sumptuousness of the dinner table and its appointments. Margaret, with her London cultivated taste, felt the number of delicacies to be oppressive. One half of the quantity would have been enough, and the effect lighter and more elegant. But it was one of Mrs. Thornton's rigorous laws of hospitality that of each separate dainty enough should be provided for all the guests to partake if they felt inclined. Careless to abstemiousness in her daily habits, it was part of her pride to set a feast before such of her guests as cared for it. Her son shared this feeling. He had never known, though he might have imagined, and had the capability to relish, any kind of society but that which depended on an exchange of superb meals, and even now, though he was denying himself the personal expenditure of an unnecessary sixpence, and had more than once regretted that the invitations for this dinner had been sent out, still, as it was to be, he was glad to see the old magnificence of preparation. Margaret and her father were the first to arrive. Mr. Hale was anxiously punctual to the time specified. There was no one upstairs in the drawing-room but Mrs. Thornton and Fanny. Every cover was taken off, and the apartment blazed forth in yellow silk damask and a brilliantly flowered carpet. Every corner seemed filled up with ornament until it became a weariness to the eye and presented a strange contrast to the bald ugliness of the lookout into the great mill yard, where wide folding gates were thrown open for the admission of carriages. The mill loomed high on the left-hand side of the windows, casting a shadow down from its many stories, which darkened the summer evening before its time. My son was engaged up to the last moment on business. He will be here directly, Mr. Hale. May I beg you to take a seat?
Mr. Hale was standing at one of the windows as Mrs. Thornton spoke. He turned away, saying,
Don't you find such close neighborhood to the mill rather unpleasant at times?
She drew herself up.
Never. I am not become so fine as to desire to forget the source of my son's wealth and power. Besides, there is not such another factory in Milton. One room alone is 220 square yards.
I meant that the smoke and the noise, the constant going out and coming in of the workpeople might be annoying.
I agree with you, Mr. Hale, said Fanny. There is a continual smell of steam and oily machinery, and the noise is perfectly deafening.
I have heard noise that was called music far more deafening. The engine room is at the straight end of the factory. We hardly hear it, except in summer weather, when all the windows are open, and as for the continual murmur of the workpeople, it disturbs me no more than the humming of a hive of bees. If I think of it at all, I connect it with my son and feel how all belongs to him and that his is the head that directs it. Just now, there are no sounds to come from the mill. The hands have been ungrateful enough to turn out, as perhaps you have heard. But the very business of which I spoke when you entered had reference to the steps he is going to take to make them learn their place.
The expression on her face, always stern, deepened into dark anger as she said this. Nor did it clear away when Mr. Thornton entered the room, for she saw, in an instant, the weight of care and anxiety which he could not shake off, although his guests received from him a greeting that appeared both cheerful and cordial. He shook hands with Margaret. He knew it was the first time their hands had met, though she was perfectly unconscious of the fact. He inquired after Mrs. Hale, and heard Mr. Hale's sanguine, hopeful account. And glancing at Margaret to understand how far she agreed with her father, he saw that no dissenting shadow crossed her face. And as he looked with this intention, he was struck anew with her great beauty. He had never seen her in such dress before, and yet now it appeared as if such elegance of attire was so befitting her noble figure and lofty serenity of countenance that she ought to go always thus apparelled. She was talking to Fanny about what he could not hear, but he saw his sister's restless way of continually arranging some part of her gown, her wandering eyes now glancing here, now there, but without any purpose in her observation. And he contrasted them uneasily with the large soft eyes that looked forth steadily at one object, as if from out their light beamed some gentle influence of repose. The curving lines of the red lips just parted in the interest of listening to what her companion said. The head a little bent forwards, so as to make a long sweeping line from the summit, where the light caught on the glossy raven hair, to the smooth ivory tip of the shoulder. The round white arms and taper hands laid lightly across each other, but perfectly motionless in their pretty attitude. Mr. Thornton sighed as he took in all this with one of his sudden comprehensive glances. And then he turned his back to the young ladies and threw himself with an effort, but with all his heart and soul, into a conversation with Mr. Hale. More people came, more and more. Fanny left Margaret's side and helped her mother to receive her guests. Mr. Thornton felt that in this influx no one was speaking to Margaret and was restless under this apparent neglect. But he never went near her himself. He did not look at her.
Only he knew what she was doing or not doing better than he knew the movements of anyone else in the room. Margaret was so unconscious of herself and so much amused by watching other people that she never thought whether she was left unnoticed or not. Somebody took her down to dinner. She did not catch the name, nor did he seem much inclined to talk to her. There was a very animated conversation going on among the gentlemen. The ladies, for the most part, were silent, employing themselves in taking notes of the dinner and criticizing each other's dresses. Margaret caught the clue to the general conversation, grew interested, and listened attentively. Mr. Horsfall, the stranger, whose visit to the town was the original germ of the party, was asking questions relative to the trade and manufactures of the place, and the rest of the gentlemen, all Milton men, were giving him answers and explanations. Some dispute arose, which was warmly contested. It was referred to Mr. Thornton, who had hardly spoken before, but who now gave an opinion, the grounds of which were so clearly stated that even the opponents yielded. Margaret's attention was thus called to her host. His whole manner as master of the house and entertainer of his friends was so straightforward, yet simple and modest, as to be thoroughly dignified. Margaret thought she had never seen him to so much advantage. When he had come to their house, there had always been something either of over-eagerness or of that kind of vexed annoyance which seemed ready to presuppose that he was unjustly judged and yet felt too proud to try and make himself better understood. But now, among his fellows, there was no uncertainty as to his position. He was regarded by them as a man of great force of character, of power in many ways. There was no need to struggle for their respect. He had it, and he knew it, and the security of this gave a fine, grand quietness to his voice and ways, which Margaret had missed before. He was not in the habit of talking to ladies, and what he did say was a little formal. To Margaret herself he hardly spoke at all. She was surprised to think how much she enjoyed this dinner. She knew enough now to understand many local interests, nay, even some of the technical words employed by the eager mill owners. She silently took a very decided part in the question they were discussing. At any rate, they talked in desperate earnest, not in the used-up style that wearied her so in the old London parties. She wondered that with all this dwelling on the manufactures and trade of the place, no allusion was made to the strike then pending. She did not yet know how coolly such things were taken by the masters as having only one possible end. To be sure, the men were cutting their own throats as they had done many a time before, but if they would be fools and put themselves into the hands of a rascally set of paid delegates, they must take the consequence. One or two thought Thornton looked out of spirits, and of course he must lose by this turnout. But it was an accident that might happen to themselves any day, and Thornton was as good to manage a strike as anyone, for he was as iron a chap as any in Milton. The hands had mistaken their man in trying that dodge on him, and they chuckled inwardly at the idea of the workmen's discomfiture and defeat in their attempt to alter one iota of what Thornton had decreed. It was rather dull for Margaret after dinner. She was glad when the gentlemen came, not merely because she caught her father's eye to brighten her sleepiness up, but because she could listen to something larger and grander than the petty interests which the ladies had been talking about. She liked the exultation in the sense of power which these Milton men had. It might be rather rampant in its display and savor of boasting, but still they seemed to defy the old limits of possibility in a kind of fine intoxication caused by the recollection of what had been achieved and what yet should be. If in her cooler moments she might not approve of their spirit in all things, still there was much to admire in their forgetfulness of themselves in the present, in their anticipated triumphs over all inanimate matter at some future time which none of them should live to see. She was rather startled when Mr. Thornton spoke to her, close at her elbow.
"I could see you were on our side in our discussion at dinner, were you not, Miss Hale?"
"Certainly, but then I know so little about it. I was surprised, however, to find from what Mr. Horsfall said that there were others who thought in so diametrically opposed a manner as the Mr. Morrison he spoke about. He cannot be a gentleman, is he?"
"I am not quite the person to decide on another's gentlemanliness, Miss Hale. I mean, I don't quite understand your application of the word, but I should say that this Morrison is no true man. I don't know who he is. I merely judge him from Mr. Horsfall's account."
"I suspect my gentleman includes your true man."
"And a great deal more, you would imply. I differ from you. A man is to me a higher and completer being than a gentleman."
"What do you mean?" asked Margaret. "We must understand the words differently."
"I take it that a gentleman is a term that only describes a person in his relation to others, but when we speak of him as a man, we consider him not merely with regard to his fellow men, but in relation to himself, to life, to time, to eternity. A castaway lonely as Robinson Crusoe, a prisoner immured in a dungeon for life. Nay, even a saint in Patmos has his endurance, his strength, his faith, best described by being spoken of as a man. I am rather weary of this word gentlemanly, which seems to me to be often inappropriately used, and often, too, with such exaggerated distortion of meaning, while the full simplicity of the noun man and the adjective manly are unacknowledged, that I am induced to class it with the cant of the day."
Margaret thought a moment, but before she could speak her slow conviction, he was called away by some of the eager manufacturers, whose speeches she could not hear, though she could guess at their import by the short, clear answers Mr. Thornton gave, which came steady and firm as the boom of a distant minute gun. They were evidently talking of the turnout and suggesting what course had best be pursued. She heard Mr. Thornton say,
"That has been done."
Then came a hurried murmur in which two or three joined.
"All those arrangements have been made."
Some doubts were implied, some difficulties named by Mr. Slickson, who took hold of Mr. Thornton's arm, the better to impress his words. Mr. Thornton moved slightly away, lifted his eyebrows a very little, and then replied,
"I take the risk. You need not join in it unless you choose."
Still, some more fears were urged.
"I'm not afraid of anything so dastardly as incendiarism. We are open enemies, and I can protect myself from any violence that I apprehend. And I will assuredly protect all others who come to me for work. They know my determination by this time as well and as fully as you do."
Mr. Horsfall took him a little on one side, as Margaret conjectured, to ask him some other question about the strike. But in truth, it was to inquire who she herself was, so quiet, so stately, and so beautiful.
"A Milton lady?"
asked he, as the name was given.
"No, from the south of England, Hampshire, I believe," was the cold, indifferent answer.
Mrs. Slickson was catechizing Fanny on the same subject.
"Who is that fine, distinguished-looking girl? A sister of Mr. Horsfall's?" "Oh, dear, no. That is Mr. Hale, her father, talking now to Mr. Stevens. He gives lessons. That is to say, he reads with young men. My brother John goes to him twice a week, and so he begged Mama to ask them here in hopes of getting him known. I believe we have some of their prospectuses, if you would like to have one."
"Mr. Thornton,
Does it really find time to read with a tutor in the midst of all his business and this abominable strike in hand as well?
Fanny was not sure from Mrs. Lixon's manner whether she ought to be proud or ashamed of her brother's conduct, and like all people who try and take other people's ought for the rule of their feelings, she was inclined to blush for any singularity of action. Her shame was interrupted by the dispersion of the guests. Chapter 21. The Dark Night. On earth is known to none the smile that is not sister to a tear. Eliot. Margaret and her father walked home. The night was fine, the streets clean, and with her pretty white silk, like Leezy Lindsay's gown of green satin in the ballad, kilted up to her knee, she was off with her father, ready to dance along with the excitement of the cool, fresh night air.
I rather think Thornton is not quite easy in his mind about this strike. He seemed very anxious tonight.
I should wonder if he were not. But he spoke with his usual coolness to the others when they suggested different things just before we came away.
So he did after dinner as well. It would take a good deal to stir him from his cool manner of speaking, but his face strikes me as anxious.
I should be if I were he. He must know of the growing anger and hardly smothered hatred of his workpeople, who all look upon him as what the Bible calls a hard man, not so much unjust as unfeeling, clear in judgment, standing upon his rights, as no human being ought to stand, considering what we and all our petty rights are in the sight of the Almighty. I am glad you think he looks anxious. When I remember Boucher's half-mad words and ways, I cannot bear to think how coolly Mr. Thornton spoke.
In the first place, I am not so convinced as you are about that man Boucher's utter distress. For the moment, he was badly off, I don't doubt. But there is always a mysterious supply of money from these unions, and from what you said, it was evident the man was of a passionate, demonstrative nature, and gave strong expression to all he felt.
Oh, Papa!
Well, I only want you to do justice to Mr. Thornton, who is, I suspect, of an exactly opposite nature. A man who is far too proud to show his feelings. Just the character I should have thought beforehand you would have admired, Margaret.
So I do. So I should, but I don't feel quite so sure as you do of the existence of those feelings. He is a man of great strength of character, of unusual intellect, considering the few advantages he's had.
Not so few. He has led a practical life from a very early age, has been called upon to exercise judgment and self-control. All that develops one part of the intellect. To be sure, he needs some of the knowledge of the past which gives the truest basis for conjecture as to the future. But he knows this need. He perceives it, and that is something. You are quite prejudiced against Mr. Thornton, Margaret.
He is the first specimen of a manufacturer, of a person engaged in trade, that I had ever the opportunity of studying, Papa. He is my first olive. Let me make a face while I swallow it. I know he is good of his kind, and by I shall like the kind. I rather think I am already beginning to do so. I was very much interested by what the gentlemen were talking about, although I did not understand half of it. I was quite sorry when Miss Thornton came to take me to the other end of the room, saying she was sure I should be uncomfortable at being the only lady among so many gentlemen. I had never thought about it. I was so busy listening. And the ladies were so dull, Papa. Oh, so dull! Yet I think it was clever, too.
It reminded me of our old game of having each so many nouns to introduce into a sentence.
What do you mean, child? Asked Mr. Hale.
Why, they took nouns that were signs of things which gave evidence of wealth. Housekeepers, undergardeners, extent of glass, valuable lace, diamonds, and all such things. And each one formed her speech so as to bring them all in the prettiest accidental manner possible.
You will be as proud of your one servant when you get her, if all is true about her that Mrs. Thornton says.
To be sure I shall. I felt like a great hypocrite tonight, sitting there in my white silk gown, with my idle hands before me, when I remembered all the good, thorough housework they had done today. They took me for a fine lady, I'm sure.
Even I was mistaken enough to think you looked like a lady, my dear, said Mr. Hale, quietly smiling.
But smiles were changed to white and trembling looks when they saw Dixon's face as she opened the door.
Oh, Master! Oh, Miss Margaret! Thank God you are come! Dr. Donaldson is here. The servant next door went for him, for the charwoman has gone home. She's better now, but, oh, sir, I thought she'd have died an hour ago.
Mr. Hale caught Margaret's arm to steady himself from falling. He looked at her face and saw an expression upon it of surprise and extremest sorrow, but not the agony of terror that contracted his own unprepared heart. She knew more than he did, and yet she listened with that hopeless expression of awed apprehension.
Oh, I should not have left her, wicked daughter that I am, moaned forth Margaret, as she supported her trembling father's hasty steps upstairs.
Dr. Donaldson met them on the landing.
She is better now, he whispered. The opiate has taken effect. The spasms were very bad. No wonder they frightened your maid, but she'll rally this time.
This time, let me go to her.
Half an hour ago, Mr. Hale was a middle-aged man. Now his sight was dim, his senses wavering, his walk tottering, as if he were 70 years of age.
Dr. Donaldson took his arm and led him into the bedroom. Margaret followed close. There lay her mother, with an unmistakable look on her face. She might be better now. She was sleeping, but death had signed her for his own, and it was clear that ere long he would return to take possession. Mr. Hale looked at her for some time without a word. Then he began to shake all over, and turning away from Dr. Donaldson's anxious care, he groped to find the door. He could not see it, although several candles, brought in the sudden affright, were burning and flaring there. He staggered into the drawing-room and felt about for a chair. Dr. Donaldson wheeled one to him and placed him in it. He felt his pulse.
"Speak to him, Miss Hale. We must rouse him."
"Papa!"
said Margaret, with a crying voice that was wild with pain.
"Papa, speak to me!"
The speculation came again into his eyes, and he made a great effort.
"Margaret, did you know of this? Oh, it was cruel of you."
"No, sir, it was not cruel," replied Dr. Donaldson with quick decision. "Miss Hale acted under my directions. There may have been mistake, but it was not cruel. Your wife will be a different creature tomorrow, I trust. She has had spasms, as I anticipated, though I did not tell Miss Hale of my apprehensions. She has taken the opiate I brought with me. She will have a good long sleep, and tomorrow that look which has alarmed you so much will have passed away."
"But not the disease."
Dr. Donaldson glanced at Margaret. Her bent head, her face raised with no appeal for a temporary reprieve, showed that quick observer of human nature that she thought it better that the whole truth should be told.
"Not the disease. We cannot touch the disease with all our poor vaunted skill. We can only delay its progress, alleviate the pain it causes. be a man, sir, a Christian. Have faith in the immortality of the soul, which no pain, no mortal disease can assail or touch.
But all the reply he got was in the choked words,
You have never been married, Dr. Donaldson. You do not know what it is.
And in the deep, manly sobs which went through the stillness of the night like heavy pulses of agony, Margaret knelt by him, caressing him with tearful caresses. No one, not even Dr. Donaldson, knew how the time went by. Mr. Hale was the first to dare to speak of the necessities of the present moment.
What must we do? Asked he. Tell us both. Margaret is my staff, my right hand.
Dr. Donaldson gave his clear, sensible directions. No fear for tonight, nay, even peace for tomorrow and for many days yet, but no enduring hope of recovery. He advised Mr. Hale to go to bed and leave only one to watch the slumber, which he hoped would be undisturbed. He promised to come again early in the morning, and with a warm and kindly shake of the hand he left them. They spoke but few words. They were too much exhausted by their terror to do more than decide upon the immediate course of action. Mr. Hale was resolved to sit up through the night, and all that Margaret could do was to prevail upon him to rest on the drawing-room sofa. Dixon stoutly and bluntly refused to go to bed, and as for Margaret, it was simply impossible that she should leave her mother, let all the doctors in the world speak of husbanding resources and one watcher only being required. So Dixon sat and stared and winked and drooped and picked herself up again with a jerk and finally gave up the battle and fairly snored. Margaret had taken off her gown and tossed it aside with a sort of impatient disgust, put on a dressing gown. She felt as if she never could sleep again, as if her whole senses were acutely vital and all endued with double keenness for the purposes of watching. Every sight and sound, nay, even every thought, touched some nerve to the very quick. For more than 2 hours she heard her father's restless movements in the next room. He came perpetually to the door of her mother's chamber, pausing there to listen, till she, not hearing his close unseen presence, went and opened it to tell him how all went on, in reply to the questions his baked lips could hardly form. At last he, too, fell asleep, and all the house was still. Margaret sat behind the curtain, thinking. Far away in time, far away in space, seemed all the interests of past days. Not more than 36 hours ago she cared for Bessie Higgins and her father, and her heart was wrung for Boucher. Now that was all like a dreaming memory of some former life. Everything that had passed out of doors seemed dissevered from her mother, and therefore unreal. Even Harley Street appeared more distinct. There she remembered, as if it were yesterday, how she had pleased herself with tracing out her mother's features in her Aunt Shaw's face, and how letters had come, making her dwell on the thoughts of home with all the longing of love. Helston itself was in the dim past. The dull gray days of the preceding winter and spring, so uneventless and monotonous, seemed more associated with what she cared for now above all price. She would fain have caught at the skirts of that departing time and prayed it to return and give her back what she had too little valued while it was yet in her possession. What a vain show life seemed! How unsubstantial and flickering and flitting! It was as if from some aerial belfry high up above the stir and jar of the earth there was a bell continually tolling. All our shadows, all our passing, all is past. And when the morning dawned, cool and gray, like many a happier morning before, when Margaret looked one by one at the sleepers,
It seemed as if the terrible night were unreal as a dream. It, too, was a shadow. It, too, was past. Mrs. Hale herself was not aware when she awoke how ill she had been the night before. She was rather surprised at Dr. Donaldson's early visit and perplexed by the anxious faces of husband and child. She consented to remain in bed that day, saying she certainly was tired, but the next she insisted on getting up, and Dr. Donaldson gave his consent to her returning into the drawing room. She was restless and uncomfortable in every position, and before night she became very feverish. Mr. Hale was utterly listless and incapable of deciding on anything. "What can we do to spare Mama such another night?" asked Margaret on the third day.
"It is, to a certain degree, the reaction after the powerful opiates I have been obliged to use. It is more painful for you to see than for her to bear, I believe. But I think if we could get a waterbed, it might be a good thing. Not but what she will be better tomorrow. Pretty much like herself as she was before this attack. Still, I should like her to have a waterbed. Mrs. Thornton has one, I know. I'll try and call there this afternoon. Stay," said he, his eye catching on Margaret's face, blanched with watching in a sick room. "I'm not sure whether I can go. I have a long round to take. It would do you no harm to have a brisk walk to Marlborough Street and ask Mrs. Thornton if she can spare it."
"Certainly," said Margaret. "I could go while Mama is asleep this afternoon. I'm sure Mrs. Thornton would lend it to us."
Dr. Donaldson's experience told them rightly. Mrs. Hale seemed to shake off the consequences of her attack and looked brighter and better this afternoon than Margaret had ever hoped to see her again. Her daughter left her after dinner, sitting in her easy chair, with her hand lying in her husband's, who looked more worn and suffering than she by far. Still, he could smile now, rather slowly, rather faintly, it is true, but a day or two before, Margaret never thought to see him smile again. It was about 2 miles from their house in Crampton Crescent to Marlborough Street. It was too hot to walk very quickly. An August sun beat straight down into the street at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Margaret went along without noticing anything very different from usual in the first mile and a half of her journey. She was absorbed in her own thoughts and had learnt by this time to thread her way through the irregular stream of human beings that flowed through Milton streets. But by and by she was struck with an unusual heaving among the mass of people in the crowded road on which she was entering. They did not appear to be moving on, so much as talking and listening and buzzing with excitement, without much stirring from the spot where they might happen to be. Still, as they made way for her, and wrapped up in the purpose of her errand and the necessities that suggested it, she was less quick of observation than she might have been if her mind had been at ease. She had got into Marlborough Street before the full conviction forced itself upon her that there was a restless, oppressive sense of irritation abroad among the people, a thunderous atmosphere, morally as well as physically, around her. From every narrow lane opening out onto Marlborough Street came up a low, distant roar, as of myriads of fierce, indignant voices. The inhabitants of each poor, squalid dwelling were gathered round the doors and windows, if indeed they were not actually standing in the middle of the narrow ways, all with looks intent towards one point. Marlborough Street itself was the focus of all those human eyes that betrayed intensest interest of various kinds, some fierce with anger, some lowering with relentless threats, some dilated with fear or imploring entreaty, and, as Margaret reached the small side entrance by the folding doors in the great dead wall of Marlborough Mill Yard and waited the porter's answer to the bell, she looked round and heard the first long, far-off roll of the tempest. saw the first slow surging wave of the dark crowd come, with its threatening crest, tumble over and retreat at the far end of the street, which a moment ago seemed so full of repressed noise, but which now was ominously still. All these circumstances forced themselves on Margaret's notice, but did not sink down into her preoccupied heart. She did not know what they meant, what was their deep significance. While she did know, did feel the keen, sharp pressure of the knife that was soon to stab her through and through by leaving her motherless. She was trying to realize that, in order that, when it came, she might be ready to comfort her father. The porter opened the door cautiously, not nearly wide enough to admit her.
"It's you, is it, ma'am?"
said he, drawing a long breath and widening the entrance, but still not opening it fully. Margaret went in. He hastily bolted it behind her.
"The folk are all coming up here, I reckon?"
asked he. "I don't know. Something unusual seemed going on, but this street is quite empty, I think." She went across the yard and up the steps to the house door. There was no near sound, no steam engine at work with beat and pant, no click of machinery or mingling and clashing of many sharp voices. But far away, the ominous gathering roar, deep clamoring.
Okay, before we get to the waterbed, did you not love the description of the game of words that she used to play? I had to go back and I had to listen to it a couple of times to get kind of the full picture. It was in that moment when Margaret was talking about being at the party, and she said she was kind of unhappy when Miss Thornton came, that's Fanny, came to take her to the other end of the room to go sit with the women, saying she was sure I should be uncomfortable at being the only lady among so many gentlemen. Which, first off, is wild. Margaret's just hanging out with the guys, listening to all the political talk and business talk, which is awesome. And then she said, "I never thought about it. I was so busy listening, and the ladies were so dull." But I think it was clever, too. It reminded me of our old game of having each so many nouns to introduce in a sentence. And her father's like, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Why, they took nouns that were signs of things which gave evidence of wealth. Things like housekeepers, undergardeners, extent of glass, valuable lace, diamonds, and all those kinds of things. And each one formed her speech so as to bring them all in the prettiest accidental manner possible." So whatever her old game of having each so many nouns to introduce into a sentence, whatever that was and who she played it with, whether it was her father or her friends in London, it was the women on the women's side of the room who were each trying to bring words of wealth into their own speech while they were sitting around and talking to each other. It was like they were trying to put on airs and use the language of the world around them and make sure that they commented on everything as much as possible and how beautiful it all was. And again, you know, we had another moment here where Margaret was like, "It's a little too much. It's a little too bright. It's a little too many sweets. It's a little over." But everybody else, of course, is very happy to be there. And then we get to the waterbed. Did you just go, "What?" when you heard that? It's a thing. It actually is a thing. There were waterbeds back then. As far as I can understand, it must have been some kind of a tub, a bath, that contained water, probably warm to begin with, but it would become not so after a while. And they covered the bath with a canvas sheet that had been infused with rubber, so it was waterproof, because there was access at this time to rubber. So you have this waterproof rubber canvas top, and then they put kind of normal, lightweight, normal bedding on top of that. And then your sick person who we can assume is having a hard time moving, could lie on this, and the softness and comfort of being on this kind of malleable surface helped to prevent bed sores, or at least that was the theory put forward by a Scottish physician who evidently invented this but didn't patent it. So somebody else got the patent on it, but it was a thing. So Margaret goes and asks for a waterbed. Now, why Mrs. Thornton had a waterbed when she is absolutely not an invalid is beyond me. Does it just, I don't know. Did she just want to have it because it was the next new thing? I don't know. But it was a convenient thing for Margaret to need to go get. And an interesting one, too. I've learned more little tidbits about life in Victorian England from this book than I think I ever expected to. So, there you are. Next week, we get the next bit. Because you know something is coming. Margaret could hear it coming. And that's going to happen in our next chapter. The other thing that is happening is between now and when I record for the next chapter, I am going to check the video of North and South, and I'll let you know. I think after next week, after episode 345, it will be safe for you to watch the second episode of the North and South miniseries. If you have it on a streaming on Netflix, or if you have the DVDs, it's broken into four parts, and I think you'll be able to watch part two safely without ruination raining down upon you after 345. So I'll let you know next week. So hold back for just a little bit or just a little longer. Have a great week. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Like Craftlit? Leave us a review on iTunes, like us on Facebook, or post a link to us when you comment on literary blogs. You can listen via Stitcher Radio, craftlit.com, or via our Android, our new Windows 8, or iPhone app. You can also use the free Craftlit app to access premium subscriber content.
Craftlit is and has been made possible by the support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.